everybody. Welcome back. This is Richard Sachs. I'm your host on Lost Arts Radio, and we're back with our friend Joel Skousen for the continuation of the history of the deep state. And you remember the last two episodes that we did, which I really recommend that you go back and watch all of them up to now so that you'll get this current one in context, at least soon after, if not before. And we were talking in the last two about the phony war on terror. The first was kind of the first section of that, and then we got more deeply into it last time. So let's see where Joel wants to go. This is Joel Skousen, Navy pilot, editor of World Affairs Brief, which you can get a free copy of for a sample if you want to, and I recommend doing that, and also the author of The Secure Home and Strategic Relocation, great books, which I recommend too. And he's been a consultant for a long time on intentional communities and building and upgrading secure homes and a lot of things connected to that, which we'll get into later in the series. But for now, let's see where we go after the main body of the phony war on terror last time. So welcome back, Joel. And what do we have next?
Thank you very much. We talked about the specifics of the 9/11 attack and starting the war on terror. I want to go back this time first and fill in some of the blanks from 2001 through 2005, the specifics. First of all, even going back to the election of George W. Bush, the conservatives were just euphoric that a conservative was finally going to replace Bill Clinton. But it's very telling that Bush did not overturn any of the Clinton executive orders that he signed just before he left office. And Bush could have done that. Not a single one. And of course, when Clinton left office, he exonerated and gave a pardon to hundreds of people, including his brother, who was guilty in prison, as well as the worst one, of course, was Mark Rich. Mark Rich was the international financier that actually, he was guilty of tax evasion, and that's why he fled the country and became an international financier. But he is the one that I suspect set up the Clintons' secret Swiss bank accounts and operated their money laundering aspect. And so that's why he deserved a pardon. It's interesting that Mark Rich was also involved in setting up a special slush fund for Yasser Arafat, who was the radical leader of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And what's interesting is that Mark Rich, being Jewish, was also tied to Israel, and Israel was tied to getting this money set up for Arafat. In other words, Israel was playing like Arafat was our enemy, but in fact, Israel has been long ruled by globalists, and those globalists were controlling Arafat. And I mean, this was $300 million they had in his bank account when Arafat died in 2004, I believe, which happened during this period. But this is a very incestuous relationship with how the international banking establishment covers up for various globalists. I pointed out in our last one that the Patriot Act was already written. It's a very long document, very detailed, came out within a day, of 9/11. So they obviously had it written beforehand. It authorized domestic spying because based upon the war on terror, it gave them the power, government, the power to censor. None of these things could have been done without a new Pearl Harbor terrorist type attack. Mm-hmm. I also want to, in going back, I want to cover the fact that there was a lot of information given about prior knowledge that the U.S. government had of this attack coming. Various high and influential people were warned not to fly on 9/11. Israel warned the U.S. a week in advance about the war on terror. And, this is kind of interesting because, Israel obviously had advance notice. They had a team of people filming they basically had some students who were working for a construction company. This was a cover. It was a CIA Mossad operation. They were filming and rejoicing. And that got the attention of some media people, especially the alternate media, and helped fuel the conspiracy theories that Israel is behind everything that happens in the United States. And I don't hold that point of view. I believe that Israel is a part of the deep state and does their international dirty work as well as domestic spying. And I think I covered that before too, that Israel has been able to set up the equipment to do most of the domestic spying on behalf of the NSA and the government as a subcontractor for two reasons. One, so that if caught, the government could say it wasn't us, it was Israel.
Right.
And you know, Israel has this sacrosanct position in American politics that nobody can criticize Israel without being called anti-Semitic. And so there was a good deal of cover in saying, you know, we can let the Israelis take the blame if we get caught in spying, because nobody can hurt the Israelis. But secondly, because it was allowing Israel to steal technology as they surveilled and spied on everyone's telephone, including corporations. They were able to steal a lot of technology and get ahead technologically to boost Israeli technical sector, which is one of the most advanced in the world now. And sadly, they're allowed to share that technology with, not share, but sell that technology to China. And so that's one of the backdoor ways in which the deep state is being able to build future enemies, Russia and China, through Israel. Israel doesn't export to Russia, but it does to China. Other evidence of prior knowledge, the FBI was tracking all of the hijackers that it listed on that. In fact, a lot of them were CIA agents for a long time before. Many agents actually tried to blow the whistle on these hijackers, including the flight schools where they were taking flying lessons and couldn't fly. And these were Arabs, and the flight schools had contacted the FBI and tried to warn them that these were, that there was something up. And the FBI systematically shut down all of these whistleblowers. There was also the financial speculation, shorting stocks in the airliners that happened before that. Certain military bases were put on alert prior to 9/11. And so all through this period that I'm going to cover, 2001 through 2005 to 7 or so, the cover-up of the 9/11 continued. In for every year, we found out more about government involvement in 9/11, and every year they covered up greater and greater evidence, especially in the 9/11 Commission, which was a real sham. Staffed with establishment people, just like the JFK Assassination Committee, staffed with Warren Burger of the Supreme Court and Gerald Ford, of who became a congressman. All of these people achieved high office and were protected. But during this period, there's also a lot happening. As I said, the phony fall of the Soviet Union happened during Russia, in Russia. And as part of the ways in which the U.S. and the globalists could take advantage of this to give aid and trade to the former Soviet Union was, of course, to allow all kinds of American oil companies to come in and revamp Russia's oil company, and that's why they became a large oil producer. But also, this is when the Nunn-Lugar legislation took place, which was two senators, Senators Nunn and Senator Lugar, liberal Republicans who wanted to use taxpayer money to disarm the former Soviet Union. Basically, they would pay to refurbish or to destroy and dismantle not only the chemical weapons and all of the pollution that chemical weapons factories had created in Russia, that we at taxpayers' expense were going to, you know, take over and take care of, but also the dismantling of a lot of SS-18, the liquid fuel rockets that had 10 warheads on them. But we ended up giving all the warheads back to Russia. We built a state-of-the-art warhead refurbishing facility for Russia. And as soon as that was complete, of course, we, our inspectors were locked out of those buildings. Interestingly, Bush, supposedly as a conservative, did what Clinton could not do. He proposed a U.S.-Russia disarmament pact whereby the U.S. would destroy two-thirds of their nuclear missiles. This is typical of the way in which the globalists use a puppet conservative president to do what a Democrat cannot yet done because of conservative resistance in the United States. Bush also signed in 2001 Executive Order 13-233, which makes all presidential papers secret. Now, this was to keep anyone in the future from being able to find out through after a president had died, through presidential papers, what kind of conspiratorial things were going on. Wow. At the end of 2001, Rudy Giuliani was named Time's Man of the Year, which, as I noted in the World Affairs Brief, meant they had political ambitions for them. He was to run for president, of course, later on, based upon that recommendation. But he was a co-conspirator in that because of his foreknowledge and knowledge of the government control of 9/11 when he was mayor of New York, having got out of building number 7 and not warning the firefighters in the World Trade Centers that they were also going to collapse. In 2002, the Enron scandal surfaced. And this is where we found out that the big four accounting firms were basically cooking the books for big corporations. And this was part of the draw of the big state into bringing big corporations into the government, into its sphere of influence, with the promise of immunity. And we've got the big four accounting companies who will, you know, make sure that we cover for you. For example, Enron had, it must have been 800 or 900 foreign bank accounts. And of course, if a private citizen had even one foreign bank account, you'd have to reveal that. They had hundreds of foreign bank accounts of which they were using for slush funds and stockpiling money overseas. One of their vice presidents, a Mr. Baxter, was suicided. The coroner declared it a suicide before the police had even begun their investigation, before they'd even taken the blood samples and the fingerprints and done all that. He declared it a suicide. This was clearly to silence someone so that in the ensuing investigation of the collapse of Enron, that they would not find out its government affiliations. 2002 also saw the bringing forth of military contractors in preparation for what would become the biggest ballooning of cost within the military, outside of the military, that is, the military contractors taking over a lot of operations in the military. And this was certainly, this was sold to the American people on being more economical, and it was not. These military contractors were making thousands of dollars a week as compared to soldiers. And of course, corporations like DynCorp surfaced, who we found out later became involved in drug trafficking, in sex trafficking of underage girls in Kosovo and Albania. All of that was due to the military. And that started during the Bush administration, during a conservative administration. They can get through anything relying on the patriotic fervor of conservatives to back anything that's pro-military. The war in Afghanistan began in 2002. There was a lot of bombings of civilians in the shadow war in Afghanistan. A lot of this was done by the CIA in Black Rabbit. Area commander, U.S. Army General Tommy Franks, complained that he had no authority to counterman any of the CIA black operations. And this is more proof of a government deep state that, you know, that their arm of enforcement, the CIA, could get away with murder without anyone in the Army or the regular military being able to counterman them. Chemtrailing also came to the surface during 2002. That's when the first films started to surface, proving that they were spraying within the skies. Airliners looking down and seeing another airliner start to spray and turn off and on their spraying. And the commentary of pilots discussing that.
That also shows that it's not just put into the fuel beforehand, right? Because then they couldn't turn it on and off.
That's correct. And not only that, the pilots in their filming of the chemtrailing showed that it was coming out of ports in the wings and not from the engines.
Exactly. Right.
And so contrails only come from the engines. But this was absolute proof of spraying because they had the film. And you can still see it on the Internet today on geoengineeringwatch.com. You can see the planes actually spraying out of the wings. Now they become more sophisticated after that film came out and started putting the jets spray near the engines so that you couldn't tell the difference between contrails and chemtrails.
Wow.
But as a pilot, I can tell you that there's actual proof of chemtrailing. All right, so the government's been doing that. But every time people look up at the sky and see long contrails that persist, they say they're chemtrailing today. But that really isn't true, necessarily. First of all, let me just give your audience a few points about chemtrailing. The government doesn't, we don't know why. We know that there's a lot of aluminum in this and barium, and the government is even proposing that they chemtrail in the future in order to combat global warming. So it's another one of those, but they've been chemtrailing for years before the global warming thing was even a threat. Right. So we really don't know what they're doing up there. And it's one of the best kept secrets in the world. They have started, actually up into 10 years, they started retrofitting some airliners with chemtrailing equipment. But once again, that got released to the public when one of the mechanics, leaked the fact that he was refilling these tanks, special tanks built into some of the airliners. So the government has not pursued putting a lot of chemtrailing equipment in airliners because it's just too hard to keep the secret. When you're on the military base and you do it with military airplanes, you can do that. So here's my point that people need to understand. Under certain conditions of high humidity in the high atmosphere and temperature, chemtrails or contrails can persist. In other words, if it's very dry and low humidity, those contrails, which are ice crystals formed from the water vapor coming out of as a result of combustion, will evaporate fairly quickly. The more humidity in the air, the less they will evaporate. And you can get chemtrails that even persist for contrails that persist for a couple of hours. So here's how I can judge. If you have high-powered telescope and binocular, you can look at the aircraft itself and see if the contrail or chemtrail is coming from the engines. Generally, if it's coming from the engines, it might be a contrail, but it could be a chemtrail depending on the aircraft and how it's been modified. But this is something you can always rely on. If every airplane in the sky is throwing out a long contrail, it's not chemtrailing, because only a fairly small percentage of airplanes in the sky at any one time are equipped to chemtrail. So if everything is contrailing, long contrails that persist, it's because of atmospheric conditions, it's not chemtrailing. Also, chemtrails have a slight different sheen to it. You can get kind of as the sun comes through it, a reddish to orange glow to it, which contrails don't have. That's another way that you can tell. Yeah.
I think that's true, and I've looked for it a lot, but I've never found a single day yet when that kind of a trail was coming from every aircraft. And they may exist.
Oh, yes, I have many times.
Have you seen
an experienced pilot.
Okay.
Most days in the wintertime, not in the wintertime, but in the fall and in the spring, where there's a lot of humidity in the higher altitudes, et cetera, you'll see every airplane having long contrails, every one of them.
Interesting. Yeah. And what
and
about
so you
the
know
ones
they're
that...
not chemtrailing those days. So, okay. People often email me, oh, they're chemtrailing again today because there's big contrails everywhere. And I go out in the sky and say, yep, every airplane has a long contrail. That's not chemtrailing. But it's especially telling when you have... And a lot of chemtrailers make a pattern. They'll fly in a certain pattern back and forth. Airliners never do that.
I've seen them go in circles even. I mean, it's amazing.
That's right. And regular airliners don't go in circles. So if they're coming back and forth, or if there's intermittent, they turn it off and on. That's a sign of chemtrailing.
Wow. Yeah.
And I even found that at low altitude when I was in Utah. I saw somebody come out of the military training area chemtrailing, and he was at a low enough altitude, there's no way he was contrailing. It was just too warm for that. Mm-hmm. And the spray would go on and off. It flew right over. And I could tell, this was a military transport aircraft that was equipped for chemtrailing, and he was turning it on and off or having problems with the supply of the chemtrail.
All right. Yeah, we've had I don't know if you've heard of him, Clifford Carnicom. He's one of the researchers, right? He's been on. They've actually found biological and chemical weapon components in the spray as well. He doesn't know why, but, he's done the research.
Here's my challenge to that. Chemtrailing at high altitude is very difficult to determine where it's going to land.
Right.
If the conspirators were trying to poison the people, they can't control it by putting out these chemtrails at 30,000 feet. You just can't control where it's going to come down.
So, assume everywhere, yeah.
It's very difficult to get a chemical analysis of something that is so dispersed by the time it gets down. Now, there have been some analysis of it. But to say that those are chemical warfare elements, you know, is very difficult, because that's a very complex formula. And you can get little bits and pieces of it. Doesn't mean that they're spraying chemical warfare, because believe me, that would do damage to them and their families as well. There's no way to control something spraying that high that's going to spread. And besides, they're not targeting the persons down below. Those chemtrails are not going to come down for hundreds of miles by the time they get to the Earth under most high wind conditions. The jet stream is anywhere from 30 to 100 miles an hour up there at those altitudes, and it's going to drift a long way before it comes down. So I am not willing at this point to say what they've actually been doing. I think there has been control of the weather. They might be trying to block radar or radiation signals for some reason because of the aluminum content in it. But all I do know is that it's up to no good, and it's one of the biggest long-standing conspiracies in the government to keep it secret. And so, yeah. But it's still an unknown.
And it's happening worldwide. And
it is happening in other countries.
And none of the high officials say anything. So there's some system in place that can control these high government officials across all these cultures. And it's working.
That's the system we're talking about. The deep state is more than just in the United States. They control all Western governments. In fact, every government, even poor Zelensky's government in Ukraine, has a deep state left over from the hidden communists that went underground, and they still run the bureaucracies in every one of these former Soviet states. And so even though President Trump, and I'll get into this when we talk in modern times, but even when President Trump didn't need to pressure Zelensky, there was the bureaucracy, the deep state in Ukraine, that was resistant. Because had they investigated the corruption, it would have implicated certain Ukrainians that went along with Biden in delivering the millions of dollars to Biden and the $87,000 a month to his son Hunter. So there was resistance, but it was at the lower bureaucratic level in Ukraine. So everyone has their own deep state to deal with. France, Germany, the UK, the various MI6 and MI5 are deep state organizations within Britain.
Right.
Now, going on here, in 2002, we talked about the rise of military contractors, and this is a very pernicious thing. It's actually gone down somewhat now because of all the excesses and all the bad press that military contractors got because they were above the law, obviously part of the deep state. But it was part of probable deniability, where the government could do illegal acts through contractors, and they'd have less whistleblowers, by the way. All throughout the 1980s and the 1990s, you had all these whistleblowers coming out of the military complaining about being forced to run drugs and to pack drugs in their helicopters and their airplanes and other things. And so that's when, in 2002, they started this rise of military contractors. We're not going to use military people. We get too many whistleblowers. Let's do dedicated ex-military people that we can pre-vet as being unprincipled enough that they'll keep the secrets, and we'll pay them a lot of money and blackmail them. And that's why they were involved in sex trafficking, because that's part of the blackmail routine, is that you get your DynCorp and your other military contractors involved in sex overseas, and you film them so that you've got blackmail on them so they won't become whistleblowers.
They could become government officials and industry executives, though, right?
Yeah. But normally, a lot of these hardened military people don't make good executives, and very little of them do that. The war in Afghanistan began first after the war on 9/11. A lot of bombing of civilians, etc. We saw in 2002 then the beginning of the setting of the stage for the war in Iraq. And remember, both the invasion of Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq were planned before 9/11. And Secretary of the Treasury O'Neill said that he was in a meeting where they said, we've got to get in and destroy Iraq and Afghanistan, or take over Iraq and Afghanistan, but we need an excuse to do so. That was in early summer of 2001, and 9/11 provided that excuse. They claimed that Iraq and Afghanistan were involved in the war on terror or the planning of 9/11, which wasn't true at all. They eventually transplanted some al-Qaeda and other people into Afghanistan to claim that that's where they came from. And of course, Osama bin Laden worked in Afghanistan at the behest of the CIA when he was fighting the Russians when he was there. So it was pretty easy to say that there were terrorists in Afghanistan. Also, the war against the EU started in about 2002. France began to rise up in resistance against the globalists in the EU with the National Front Party of Jean-Marie Le Pen. And there was a massive media outpouring against this right-wing extremist, Jean-Marie Le Pen. And this will then spread to other countries later on. But it started at this same time frame because of the EU. It was interesting as they were starting to pump up the war on Iraq. A couple of military people pointed out that Iran was far more advanced in weapons of mass destruction in those days than Iraq was. And so why target Iraq rather than Iran? In other parts of the country in 2002, land confiscation started in South Africa under the African National Congress, a communist terror organization. You will remember that the deep state had this, in combination with the media, had this huge boycott of South Africa for them to give up the separate form of government, whites versus the blacks, and the apartheid system.
Right.
And I've been to South Africa several times and consulted with the government on, and I warned them before giving up to apartheid. I said, you've got to revise your constitution so that no one has the power to use the majority to take other people's property. And they wouldn't do it because they were a semi-socialist country. They wanted the government to have the ability to redistribute wealth in their own form of socialism. But I said, the communists are going to take power. They've got a majority, and they're going to use those same laws to take land. And sure enough, that came true.
So but they were saying socialism good, communism bad, basically, right? Trying to hold on to that distinction.
Well, what I'm saying is that all politicians love socialism because it allows them to promise benefits to people and buy votes. All right. Now, communism is just a more virulent form of socialism, all right, where you reinforce it with tyranny. Most regular socialism is democratic socialism. In other words, you depend on being able to buy votes from people by promising benefits from other people's money. Yeah. The government becomes the redistribution of funds. And so it's very enticing for every Western country to go towards it. Even the United States has been going towards socialism for years by politicians. I mean, look what the Democrats are promising today. Medicare for all, universal income. You know, you don't have to work, but everybody gets it. See, that's the enticement of being, and that ought to be prohibited. You should have an absolute constitutional prohibition against being able to take from productive and give any benefit to another person. You cannot give benefits. You can only protect fundamental rights in the government. So the government should be prohibited against any kind of world welfare, even for the deserving poor. Because once you open the door to government being able to distribute to anybody that they want, there's no way to stop that. But anyway, I warned South Africa about that. But it was interesting. There was no media outcry against the African National Congress confiscation of land. Same thing happened in Rhodesia early on in the 90s. The media, of course, being, you know, it's leftist, yes, but more than leftist, the media is globalist. The media is part of the deep state conspiracy. And the globalism is a form of socialism. It's a milder form. It's Fabian socialism. They still tell you you're free. You still own your property. We just control it. And the controls are massive. Like in the EU, they control every aspect of your business and your import, export, etc. And that's what the British want out of us, and which is being sabotaged.
Right.
Now, in 2003, Colin Powell's show and tell at the UN happened, whereby they use satellite images and other intelligence things to falsify the case for Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction in order to justify the war in Iran or against Iraq. During the early part of 2003, the Russians authorized Saddam Hussein to transfer his chemical weapons out of Iraq to Syria so that they could not be found when international inspectors came in, and that happened now. The U.S. knew about that. They still said there were weapons of mass destruction, even though they had satellite images knowing that those weapons had been transferred to Syria, proving that they needed an excuse to attack and that they were going to do so. It's interesting that there were there was no declaration of war against Iraq. And of course, all of this War Powers Act controversy with Congressman Ron Paul came up in 2003. Well, let's have a declaration of war against Iraq. You know, no, we don't want to do that. We're just going to do this under a terrorist action, anti-terrorist action. And the reason is they want to set the stage for intervention widespread, and they've been intervening ever since. Also during 2003, the big scandal about torture came up, torture of Iraqis in the prisons there. And the secret, and as tortures, by the way, brought forth the confessions of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the so-called mastermind of 9/11. But as I pointed out on the World Affairs Brief at the time, it was so unreliable, the torture confession. He ended up torturing to every terrorist event that happened in the last 10 years, one single person confessing to it all. Yeah. It was so obvious to everyone that this was just a sham. And so, but this is happening under a conservative administration. And Attorney General Ashcroft from Missouri, and this is very telling because Missouri is a state where the CIA had set up most of their front companies during all the Iran-Contra years and all the drug importation years. Missouri was the go-to, and Ashcroft was in charge of Missouri during that period when the CIA was setting up all those funds. So that's one of the reasons why he got to be Attorney General under Bush, is that he was the CIA's man. Mm-hmm. And even though Bush and Ashcroft claimed great success in the war on terror in 2003, they continued to ask for more surveillance power. And this is typical. You accentuate the war on terror and you ask for more surveillance power. You had continual TSA increasing of their demands on American travelers. You had the shoe bomber happen, which was a falsified terrorist attempt on an airliner where a person tried to light plastic explosive hidden in the heel of a shoe.
Was that the one who got this mysterious escort telling the counter at the ticket place that he didn't need any identification?
No, that was the crotch bomber.
Oh,
so
sorry.
There are two things. There's the shoe bomber and the crotch bomber.
Right.
All right. So the shoe bomber was the first one, which forced the TSA to make sure everybody has to take off their shoes. Yeah. He tried to light plastic explosives with a match because it wouldn't go on. So here was a patsy who was mind controlled, hypnotized or some way, to get on an airplane and pretend like he was going to blow it up. It was impossible. There was no detonator in that plastic explosive. So he was told to light it with a match. Well, every Marine corporal knows that you can light plastic explosive with a match and it doesn't explode. They heat their chow with it.
Right.
They take off the plastic explosive tabs off the mortars and they heat their chow with it. So no trained terrorist would have thought that he could blow up the airplane by lighting with a match. So that was the proof that this was a patsy. Then the crotch bomber came along and he was escorted onto the airplane by a fellow from India who showed his credentials to the people and told them that he's putting this person without a passport, without any, but he was using his credentials to put the airplane on the air, on the airplane.
Do we have any idea who that was?
No, we don't. I mean, he was... there was a lawyer from, I think, Chicago who was on that airplane who documented the whole thing, and I covered that extensively in the World Affairs Brief, and he was very, very sharp about that and knew that this was obviously a government-related patsy, and he had plastic explosive hidden in his pants, in his crotch, apparently, and he, again, tried to light it with a match. And was caught.
These guys are willing to go through the unpleasantness of being in an explosive event because they're expecting to go to paradise, I assume, right? Is that
no? I don't think. For whatever reason, I think these are mind controlled and hypnotized.
Okay.
And the guy was clearly out of it, said the lawyer. You know, he said he was in a daze. He had to be hand carried, someone with his elbow walking him onto the airplane. This guy was not capable of doing it on his own. So he had to be drugged or hypnotized or in some way disabled. But I think it has to be hypnotized because at some point he's got to try to light the explosives. So,
yeah.
In any case, clearly a government operation in order to keep the people of America tied to this odious TSA requirements that we have.
Right.
Bush also began to cover for the Saudis as it became more available, the information about the Saudi involvement in the in 9/11. Both Ashcroft and Bush lobbied for the renewal of the Patriot Act. At this time, it was also became very much aware, and I covered in the World Affairs Brief, that George Shultz and Dick Cheney were really running the Bush administration. Shultz is the one who told the powers that be that he had properly got George H.W. Bush or W. Bush ready for the presidency. He was ready, even though he was a nobody. He knew nothing about foreign affairs, etc. But Dick Cheney was running the show during the Bush administration. Expanded his staff to over 600 to manage every part of government from his vice president's office. Tony Blair, who was a Marxist in the UK, became prime minister, and he was also deeply involved in getting the UK to go along with the attack on Iraq. I think that he became a globalist. He's like Barack Obama, starts out as a Marxist, was bought out by the globalists, became a globalist puppet, and was made wealthy. They don't make communists wealthy, but they do make communists who join the globalists wealthy. Bob Woodward's book, Plan of Attack, came out in 2003, which outlined all of the details within the Bush administration about planning to attack Iraq and Afghanistan without justification before the war. In 2004, the torture became an issue again. And there were a lot of false flag claims about suitcase nukes out of Iraqis and other people in the United States, which I took time to debunk. Suitcase nukes, by the way, are the crown jewel of nuclear technology. You have it so miniaturized that you can put it in a suitcase. Hmm. And the trigger events, the tritium triggers within the suitcase nukes have to be renewed every year. So it is not possible to have a stolen suitcase nuke that is going to be usable indefinitely, hidden in things. And these are the most highly prized weapons of the Soviet Union or China or the U.S., and they are not lost to terror. These things are put out as to foment the world on terror, to keep people afraid of this image of terrorism, to claim that suitcase nukes were stolen from the former Soviet Union. As I say, it never really fell. The government and military never lost control of their nukes, let alone the suitcase nukes.
Okay.
Revelations of Israeli spying came out again in 2004. The U.S. had to cover up and explain it away. Arafat died, and it was found out that he had over $300 million in a secret bank account in Switzerland, set up by the Israelis through Mark Rich. Interesting.
Okay. Yeah. Most people would never believe that kind of connection.
George W. Bush wins a second term over John Kerry. And they began now to target Iran and Syria and criticize them and their weapons of mass destruction. In 2005, we have more of everything, more inflation, more war, more corruption, more sin in the United States. So things are just getting worse under a Republican administration rather than better.
Right.
Now, in 2004, that's the first time we find that, by the way, I think I did cover that in the last episode, but the war in Iraq was precipitated by the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, April Glaspie, telling Saddam Hussein, or at least his ambassador, who asked the U.S. what would they think if the U.S. invaded Kuwait.
Right.
And they said the U.S. would have no opinion, meaning they gave them the go-ahead.
Yeah.
As I explained before, Kuwait and Iraq both have an oil field under their borders, and Iraq was claiming that Kuwait was drawing too much out of the same common pool. and wanted it to wanted them to invade. Now, I happen to think that Kuwait, being under the influence of the West, was told to overpump from their side so as to provoke a war with Iraq. Now, why the war in Iraq? It wasn't involved with terror. Saddam Hussein really wasn't a threat to anybody. He didn't have anything to do with 9/11. Well, in the first place, I think we have to understand the larger globalist agenda. As happened during the Clinton administration, they attacked Kosovo and Serbia. And they did so to after the phony war of the Soviet fall of the Soviet Union, in order to antagonize the Slavs against the West. Prior to that, after the fall of the Soviet Union, the Slavic people were very much pro-Western and wanted to get out far away from communism as possible. And so when the deep state authorized the bombing of civilian infrastructure in Serbia in response to the provoked war in Kosovo, Kosovo was in fact destabilized by the West by unleashing a bunch of communists from Albania, so Kosovarian communists in Albania, neighboring Albania, to come into Kosovo and tell all the Kosovarians under threat of death, you need to exit the country. So they created the exit and blamed it on the Serbs, as if the Serbs were pushing out the Kosovarians, which wasn't true at all. And so they authorized the bombing of Serbia, doing dams, electrical power plants, radio and television stations, hospitals, the U.S. bombs, civilian infrastructure, bridges, roads, nothing military, to make the Slavic people hate the U.S. So the globalist agenda means if we're going to build for a World War III agenda, we need to provoke Russia and China into attacking the West. And we need to give them an excuse so they don't look like the aggressors. So we're going to become the bullies of the world. So even though there's oil machinations and there's regime change machinations, they use the excuse of the war on terror, which they created, the deep state, to create the image of the U.S. as the bully of the world, because the people in these countries know that they aren't creating the terrorists, that somebody else is creating the terrorists. And the U.S. is coming in and bombing civilian infrastructure in order to destroy people's confidence. Now, Iraq was designated as the one to start this hatred against the West, and that's why the U.S. bombed, you know, Shiites and Sunnis and created hatred in both. Eventually bought off their militias so that they could win the war, and then proceeded to build the largest embassy in the world in the Green Zone in Baghdad. Right. And from that embassy in the world, they control the war on terror. Not from the U.S. embassies. The deep state works out of the embassy in Baghdad. That's when they operate all of their weapons depots for bringing in Soviet bloc weapons to hand over to ISIS and other controlled terrorists, all coming out of the Green Zone in Baghdad. And that's one of the reasons why they needed to take down Saddam Hussein to get control of the entire country. In addition, they knew that the ultimate target was Iran. And that's the next subject that we're aiming for. Controlling Iraq, and that's why the U.S. military is never going to leave Iraq, is because they intend to go after Iran, and Iran is a much more difficult military to take down than Iraq. As I may have pointed out, Iraq had an agreement with Russia, with the Soviet Union, to come in and help against Western, and the Russians refused. They put in a few resupply airliners, but that was it. There was no military assistance whatsoever. But the Russians did eavesdrop on the U.S. Operation Iraqi Freedom to eavesdrop on our electronic countermeasures, all of the electronic signals we would put out to jam the Russian equipment that the Iraqis had so that they could develop countermeasures. And they also developed secret anti-tank weapons, which they practiced in Iraq on U.S. tanks, killing a couple of Abram tanks. So in 2007, the U.S. had three aircraft carriers off to the shores of Iran, threatening Iran. This became known that Iran had a nuclear program. That nuclear program was, in fact, fomented by the CIA or the deep state. They used the Khan network out of Pakistan, which was a CIA operation in the ISI. The ISI is the CIA version in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Formerly run by a fellow named Khan, K-H-A-N. He was a CIA operated, and he would distribute to various entities around the world, like North Korea and Iran, plans for nuclear weapons and nuclear acceleration and enrichment programs. And he would do that so that the U.S. would have an excuse to attack those countries as threats to national security. So in essence, the U.S. built their attack on Iran based upon having fed Iran flawed plans on nuclear weapons. And they were flawed so that Iran wouldn't be able to actually build a nuclear weapon, but that the U.S. could claim that they were trying. Well, the Iranians are not dumb. The Iranians went to the French and got those plans corrected. And so they were on the road to nuclear weapons, not because they were after destroying Israel, as the U.S. claims. Right. That was mistranslation of a talk by Prime Minister Ahmadinejad. He said, basically, the people who control Israel have to be removed. And that's what he was out to destroy. And he was talking about the globalists who were in charge of Israel, who were, he knew, were part of the deep state. Right. Now, if you knew that you were in the crosshairs of the deep state or the U.S. globalists, you'd want nuclear weapons too. So I don't blame Iran for wanting them. They have never attacked another country in terms of aggressiveness except the war on Iran and Iraq, which was kind of a mutual bad actors, war.
Right.
But in any case, based upon the threat that the U.S. intelligence community said that Iran faced about weapons of mass destruction and the threat to destroy Israel, they had three aircraft carriers off the coast of Iran ready to attack, clear back in 2007. And they even shot down an Iranian airliner to provoke Iran into attacking U.S. forces. But Iran didn't take the bait because it wasn't ready to take on the West.
Yeah.
Then Ron Paul decides to run for president in 2007 for the 2008 election. And now the CIA had a real problem, because they knew that if they attacked Iran when Ron Paul was, and it caused a tremendous, difficult war, which would be very unpopular. After the war in Iraq, foreign wars were very unpopular. The U.S. wanted the troops home, and the U.S. kept dragging their feet. They finally had to ship in billions of dollars in $100 bills on pallets to buy off the various opposition forces. Otherwise, the U.S. never would have won the war in Iraq with these militias, any more than Afghanistan. You have to buy them up. And by the way, the U.S. is in Afghanistan to control the drug trade, which was formerly controlled by the Soviet Union. And they, you know, drug trade is probably three times bigger now that the U.S. has been in control and allowed these drug lords to continue to operate.
I had heard that they're also there making sure that the rare earth mineral trade for China stays safe.
Well, that's really not true. There are rare earth minerals, but China right now controls most of the rare earth minerals already in the world.
Yeah.
So you're not going to stop China's control of rare earth minerals by keeping them from coming into Afghanistan.
No, I'm saying to protect their ability to get them from Afghanistan.
To protect China's ability to get them from Afghanistan? Is that what you said?
Yeah. I'm not saying I know that's right, but that's what I'd heard.
Well, I don't know of...
That would fit into your scenario, basically.
I don't know if that's a factor. You want to remember, relative to the rare earth things, that the U.S. used to be the biggest producer of rare earth minerals.
Right.
And it still has plenty of rare earth minerals. It's just that the U.S. Kind of allowed the Chinese to undercut the price so that the U.S., through regulations, they couldn't no longer stay in business. Now, the U.S. drove the manufacturers out of business, but we've still got the capability if we have to revert to it in terms of rare earth minerals.
Right.
So Ron Paul's running for president. The U.S. decides that because of his great popularity, growing popularity about getting out of the war in Iraq, and not that the U.S. cannot attack Iran. So they modify that year's National Intelligence Estimate, the NIE, to say, after 2 years of saying Iraq and warning Iraq's nuclear program, suddenly say, I'm sorry, Iran's nuclear program, that Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapons program. Everyone's shocked. The NIE suddenly says Iran is not trying to develop nuclear weapons. And so that's an excuse to stand down. The aircraft carriers leave. Ron Paul is defeated in the primary through machinations of the Republican Party, manipulating the election to make sure he doesn't show the true results. I mean, this shows the deep state control over both parties at the highest levels. Once Ron Paul is defeated in 2008 in the primaries, three aircraft carriers back into Iraq, and the 2008 NIE says that Iran's weapons program is back online. Incredible manipulation.
Yeah. Amazing coincidence.
That's right. And so the attack has always been about Iran because Iran's the only Muslim country threatening to become self-sufficient in weapons production of everything, missiles, nuclear weapons, airplanes, drones. And they're showing that they have a formidable occasion. So what happens is Israel decides that they're not going to attack Iran. They've been tasked since 2004 to attack Iran and start the war with Iran. First of all, Iraq delayed that. They had to get Iraq out of the way. Once Iraq was out of the way, Iran is in the crosshairs. Israel gets cold feet and says to the globalists, no, we're not going to attack Iran until you get rid of Syria first, because Syria has all these chemical weapons transferred from Iran, and they've got 1,000 Scud missiles. They can overwhelm our missile defense system. You got to take care of Iran. So the U.S. decides to start to target Syria. Before they target Syria, in between this period of time, the U.S. did the color revolutions within Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya, whereby they sent in agents to destabilize, to create rebellion within the country, to destabilize particularly Gaddafi and the president of Mubarak in Egypt. And they overthrow both of them through intervention, using social media and other things to enliven people. But in Libya, they had to do a no-fly zone, which was only a one-way flow, a no-fly zone. They sent in commandos. They sent in cruise missiles. They attacked their military. They fed the arms and ammunition to the rebels so that they could defeat Muammar Gaddafi. Gaddafi was a dictator. He did have absolute powers. But if there ever was a benevolent dictator in Africa, it was Muammar Gaddafi. He used 90% of his oil revenues to fund education and welfare of the people. Right. And so it was quite a benevolent one, and the globalists couldn't have that. They overthrew them. But the reason for overthrowing it in these three countries was to create a wave of terrorists that they could import into Syria in order to overthrow Syria. And so they caused a rebellion within Syria, and there was always some opposition within Syria to the Bashar al-Assad regime. Remember, Bashar al-Assad's father was Hafez al-Assad, who was a bad guy, and he had a ruthless control over people. He was quite unpopular with a certain sector, and he ran torture. And in fact, the CIA took and sent one of their people to be tortured by Assad in Syria, called Rendition, part of a black site. Mm-hmm. So we know that Assad also had a relationship with the deep state. His preferred son to take over Syria after Assad's death died in a car crash. And so the only son left over was Bashar al-Assad, a mild-mannered Western-trained ophthalmologist who did not want to be president. But it fell to him. And he was dealing in Syria. He was a very benevolent president. He's dealing, though, with the deep state left over from his father's regime, which was doing torture and other things. And so it was very easy for the West to make contacts with the deep state aspects to continue the bad policies within Syria so they could justify intervening in Syria against Bashar al-Assad.
All of this leading to allowing Israel to do the attack they wanted on Iran.
Iran, that's right. Everything about the attack on Syria has to do with allowing Israel to be able to attack Iran without fear of retaliation from Syria.
Okay.
And so
Wasn't Israel worried about retaliation from Iran if that's the people that they were attacking?
Yes, but they knew that Iran would attack, but they knew that the U.S., I'm sorry, they knew that Iran would not only attack Israel, but that Iran would attack U.S. forces in the region. That's one of the reasons why the U.S. needed to keep forces in Iraq, so that they'd be close enough for Iran to retaliate against U.S. forces. In other words, the U.S. forces had to be bloodied in order for the U.S. to justify coming in to help Israel after Israel had been retaliated against.
I see.
It's a complex scenario, but the U.S. fully intended always to back up Israel, assured Israel, we'll be there to back you up. We will obliterate Iran's military, but you need to start it because we don't have an excuse to start it, you see. You can start it because we have interpreted this speech by Ahmadinejad to say we have to destroy Israel. And so you've got an excuse to retaliate. It's a complex thing of justifying things as they do. Now, to kind of wrap up this section, we want to remember that the U.S. started a no-fly zone in Syria.
Yeah.
And basically, it was going to be a prelude to the same thing that happened in Libya. And John Kerry was the Secretary of State during that time. He got before a London press conference. And a reporter asked him, is there anything that the Syrians can do to stop this attack that you're obviously planning? Yeah. And just off the top of his head, Kerry says, yes, they could give up their chemical weapons and we wouldn't attack. And the Syrians immediately said, we accept. The Russians also said, we accept on behalf of Syria. We'll make sure it gets done. And Kerry must have got a tongue lashing like you've never seen before when he got back to Washington and realized he had just destroyed the globalist plan to intervene in Syria. And so for the next year, after 2013, the Syrians dismantled their chemical weapons. It was certified not only by international inspectors, but by the U.S. itself. And then the U.S. had a problem in the sense that it now didn't have an excuse to go after Syria because of the chemical weapons.
Yeah.
So they began all these import of terrorists into Syria in order to create a civil war within Syria. And in the midst of that civil war, they were planning on doing a chemical attack on the civilians and blaming it on the Assad regime.
Yeah.
And that's how they would once again start a war with Syria, is through crossing a red line. Obama set these red lines that if you use chemical weapons, now, how was he supposed to use chemical weapons? The U.S. had already certified that he'd given up his chemical weapons.
Yeah.
But that's the way the U.S. operates. They were going to import chemical weapons through Saudi Arabia and Turkey so that the U.S.-backed rebels could pull off those weapons and blame Syria. And that's what happened in the first attack in Damascus. Literally impossible that Bashar al-Assad would have used chemical weapons. In the first place, it has no place in an urban environment. It's an area weapon for troops out in the open. There's no advantage to using chemical weapons. They're going to get your own soldiers. They're going to get civilians. And so no sane person would use chemical weapons in a city, only if you're going to provoke an international reaction. And so that's what happened. They provoked an international reaction and through the chemical weapons attacks. And so that's why the U.S. Restarted the war in Syria. Now, before that happened, by the way, after the chemical weapons agreement had been made, the U.S. had to have an excuse to step down from its attack status on Iran. Because remember, there were three aircraft carriers
right.
constantly off Iran threatening with an attack. But since they couldn't attack Iran until Syria was out of the way, now Syria was going to take a long more time to get out of the way. The U.S. came to Iran and said, let's make a deal on nuclear weapons. Iran didn't approach the U.S. The U.S. approached Iran in order to have an excuse to stand down. They wanted to deal with Iran. And they set the deal up so that it would have a trap in it, so that they could restart the war with Iran based upon violations of this Iran nuclear agreement once that Syria was out of the way. So that's the background between the Iran nuclear. It wasn't a stupidity on the part of Obama administration giving in to Iran. It was a trap by the CIA to have an excuse to stand down from Iran for a while and yet restart, because they put in the third round of the talks the stipulation that Iran could not develop any nuclear-capable missiles. They meant that as a ban on all missile development in Iran, but Iran got the United Nations to agree with them that the missiles that they were creating were not nuclear-capable. And thus, they got out of the trap. And that's why when Donald Trump got elected, the globalists got to him and said, now you can get out of the, because they knew the nuclear agreement wasn't going to, the trap was gone. So they set a new trap by having Trump get out of the nuclear agreement, hoping that Iran would now start to enrich uranium again so that they could re-engage and have another trap that Iran is going back to. And the reason, by the way, that Iran went back to it, it's not that they're making more enriched uranium. It's just that part of the nuclear deal that is, or that Europe was buying their excess enriched uranium to keep them below the 3% level. And once the sanctions set in, Europe was banned from buying further enriched uranium from it. So it automatically puts Iran over the limit, even though they're not creating more. Isn't that a catch-22? In other words, the U.S. backs out of the agreement, forces them, Europe, not to buy any more enriched uranium, and automatically puts Iran in violation of the agreement that they backed out of. Now, how do you go to war based upon an agreement that you backed out of and the U.S. has denied? It's incredible.
You just misrepresented, and it sounds like another version of the weapons of mass destruction terror over the media, right? They're over 3%. We have to do something.
Yeah. Now, we'll talk about this in our next episode, but this sets the stage for why the U.S. is up to no good in the Middle East. We'll talk about the Russian intervention to stop the U.S.-backed rebels from winning. And we'll talk about Israel and how they've been trying to provoke Iran into war. And we'll get into the modern period now in our next episode.
Why does the, again, you may have said this, but just to make it clearer, why does the deep state eventually want the U.S. military to attack and destroy Iran? What's the ultimate reason for that?
Because every other Muslim country in the Middle East is beholden to the West or the East for their weapon systems, and almost all of them are beholden to the West now. So they can control them. They're cannon fodder in future war. But Iran is the only Muslim country independent of either East and West in terms of weapons development, and they cannot tolerate that. And it's, by the way, the strongest of all the Middle Eastern countries.
So they would have the ability to go against the overall agenda and mess up the plans of the deep state.
And in fact, they're already doing that. Iran is being billed by the U.S. as the biggest sponsor of terror in the world. But in fact, that's the U.S. Iran is the biggest sponsor of the counter-terrorists to the U.S., meaning those like in Lebanon, Hezbollah. These are not necessarily good organizations, but Hezbollah is effective at countering the U.S.-backed rebels, and so is Iran, and so is Yemen. Iran got Yemen to switch sides in the war on terror against the U.S., and that's why Saudi Arabia is attacking Iran, Yemen. And so, in other words, that's the second reason why they want Iran out of the way. Iran knows about the phony war on terror. Iran knows what the U.S. is up to and is trying to counter. And Russia itself, except for its intervention in Syria, is not using its power to counter the U.S. because it's too early. Russia doesn't want to provoke the U.S. until their weapon systems are ready to take on the West in a full-scale war. But Iran will do what Russia can't do at this time. They're going to take on the West when provoked.
Well, and Russia and China must have a reason. If they're planning to attack the U.S. when they build up their preparedness more, they must feel that they can survive a world war with nuclear weapons.
Somehow. Every nuclear power has plans to survive the nuclear war. The U.S. has their deep bunkers, but only for the leadership.
Yeah. Well, they might have to sacrifice the citizens, but the leadership.
Yep, they won't. They know that Russia and China are not intending to hit cities. They're only hitting military targets. They want to blackmail the West into submission. Now, the U.S. and the globalists, as in World War II, have no compunction against firebombing or nuclear bombing cities. They didn't have to do it in Japan. They could have put that nuclear weapon out on a military target away from a city.
Yeah.
But didn't do it. They didn't have to firebomb Germany. They didn't have to starve 20 million Germans after World War II, but they did it. It makes the Holocaust look like a picnic compared to what the globalists did to Germany after the defeat.
Right.
In World War II. It was a true war crime.
One other little hole in what we were saying that I wanted to fill in, when the U.S. Military destroyed Libya for the reasons that you said, and also I assume because they weren't joining the BIS-centered central banking system, but when they destroyed Libya, was the Soviet Union officially an ally of Libya? And if so, what was their decision not to help?
Same thing as in Iraq. Yes, they had supplied all of the weapon systems to Iraq, including MiG aircraft, which were shot down a lot during the war in Libya. But once again, they did not come to the rescue of Libya because they did not want to get into a direct confrontation of the West too early before their preparations.
Okay. All right. All right. So we got a lot of interesting stuff coming up for next time, and we'll try to get through the week waiting for that, and then see you next time. So hold on, and we'll say goodbye in the break here.
Okay.
Okay, so there goes Joel Skousen, editor of World Affairs Brief. I hope you got a lot. I was going to say hope you enjoyed it, but it's pretty dark, you know, scenario for the future in what the picture Joel's painting. But I really appreciate what he's doing of helping people get in the right awareness level and mindset and attitude to make getting through this future challenging period more possible for all of us. It's very valuable, you know. It's just somebody talking about history and insights for the future from the history, not from things they just memorized from somebody who memorized it from somebody else who memorized it, but his own experience and insights, which I have great respect and appreciation for that. So remember that if you want a sample copy of his newsletter, World Affairs Brief, you can write to editor, which is him, which is Joel, at editor@worldaffairsbrief.com, and he'll send you a copy for free. And joelskousen.com was the site he mentioned today for getting the books, The Secure Home and The Strategic Relocation, which is really good. And so this is a good time to read those when you get a chance. Remember, besides these educational Sunday shows, we have Saturday afternoon show U.S. time. It's 4:30 Pacific, 7:30 Eastern U.S. time. It's called Lost Arts Radio Live. That is looking at different aspects of our bigger picture situation every week and inviting your feedback from all of that. Half an hour after that finishes, we air the private platform club meeting for Planetary Healing Club. That's for people that wanted to get into the deeper aspect of it that we can't easily share in the public forums, and we don't want to get it banned or censored right away. And that's interactive, and I'm live every week there with Doug and with all of you guys. If you want to sign up for that, you can have access to it through planetaryhealingclub.com. Which is the access page. And then if you have questions about it, you're wondering if it's worth the time for you to be part of that, you can always ask questions by email, richard@lostartsradio.com. Also, suggestions for subjects you want covered, either in the club, in the interactive private meeting, or in public shows, just write to me for that too if you want to. We also have a Subscribestar page, which is set up if you have the means and the interest to support us. We're not running commercials or pushing products, or and when I recommend products, it's because I think you might get value out of them, not because I'm getting paid to do it, at least up to now. And so we need money. And if you're in a position and want to help us, you can do that either through subscribestar.com/lostartsradio or the direct donate buttons on either one of our sites, which are lostartsradio.com. or our nonprofit site that we hope will be able to build a school in the future, depending on the funds that come in, and that's Lost Arts Research Institute.org. And you can see both a donate button there and a physical address if you'd rather use that for donations. That's how we, you know, hope to keep going and expand the work that we're doing if you agree with us that it's worthwhile. And if you have means to do more than that, just let me know and we'll talk about it. I'll do some private one-on-one sessions when I have time. People that want to implement some of these things, especially related to the health work that I've done over the last half century or so on aging and degenerative disease and immunity and things like that. Just write to me if you want details on that. And let's see what else. Our main site, lostartsradio.com, has a place where you can sign up for the mailing list. And if we disappear off major platforms and you want us to be able to reach you with videos or other kinds of information, just sign up for that mailing list at lostartsradio.com or text your name and email to text your name and email address to get on the mailing list to 928-235-4676, or you can write what I was thinking of. You can write to info@lostartsradio.com, a name and an email address, and you'll be on that list as well for if we need it in the future. Other than that, I think that's about it. We always like to hear your feedback, so feel free to reach out to either one of us, Richard or Doug, at lostartsradio.com, and we read everything that you send in and respond as time allows, and really appreciate you sharing the time with us. Take a look at Joel's information on his sites and in his books. It's really well worth studying, and we'll look forward to seeing you next time. Talk to you soon.
Introducing Lost Arts Radio on Subscribestar.com. Just go to Subscribestar.com/Lost Arts Radio to find our rewards program, offering 10 different giving levels starting at just $5 a month. We offer incredible value for any rewards level, from extra monthly interview videos not available publicly to subscription-based Planetary Healing Club videos once, twice, or three times a month, to private counseling sessions with Lost Arts Radio host Richard Sachs, to tech help with me, Doug Diamond. We even have one option where you can be the star on Lost Arts Radio as our guest on a specially produced show just for you. We conduct an interview with you and broadcast it to our growing network and listenership. Our Subscribe Star levels are one of a kind and offer great rewards for any budget. Please help support Lost Arts Radio. We can't do it without you. With increasing censorship on many of our channels, we really need your support today to keep doing what we're doing. As Richard says, we're not even at survival level yet. Lost Arts Radio has three weekly shows. Lost Arts Radio Live each Saturday night at 7:30 Eastern, 4:30 Pacific, which is a live stream currently on multiple platforms in case we get banned from some of the larger ones. Right now, we're on two YouTube channels, Facebook Live, Periscope, which is Twitter, Twitch, and DLive. You can access these broadcasts by going to www.lostartsradio.com/live for all the links to those channels. The Planetary Healing Club meets right after Lost Arts Radio Live at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific on Saturday nights. And our Sunday show with guests airs at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific on Sunday nights on our Blog Talk Radio channel, our YouTube channels, Facebook pages, and on Brighteon. Be sure to sign up for our free email list just in case we do get banned on big tech's platforms. It's just a matter of time, really. They don't like the stuff we talk about, and they do not want the truth out there. In fact, they have already attacked us numerous times. Join our free email list so we can let you know where we are and how to access our shows. The sign-up button is right on the top right on most pages of our website. The best starting point for all things Lost Arts Radio is our main site, lostartsradio.com, where you can find the hottest news selection videos that we curate just for you. Those are on the homepage and added to daily, as well as articles and breaking news about information you really need to know. Our show archives, the 10 most recent shows, are right on our homepage, as well as our Blog Talk Radio page at blogtalkradio.com/lostartsradio. Or just click the All Things Radio Show tab right on our website. We're in the podcast directory on iTunes, and all of our shows except the banned ones are on our YouTube channels at Lost Arts Radio and at Diamond Disc. Our Brighteon page is really taking off, and we often have editors' picks videos right on their homepage. Visit Brighteon.com/channel/Lost Arts Radio. On our site, you can also access our free listener forum as well as sign up for the Planetary Healing Club, which is just $25 a month, where you get private access to a one-on-one interaction with host Richard Sacks and myself and the other club members who participate live. More info can be found at planetaryhealingclub.com. We're providing solutions in there to make the world a better place. Come join us. Stay tuned because up next, you'll get to hear a really great song by an independent artist that we're doing our best to support. Go to lostartsradio.com/music for the full list of all the great songs and bands that we spin on our audio-only podcast shows. If you're in a band and want to submit a song for consideration for airplay on Lost Arts Radio, visit my website at diamonddiscaudio.com for more information about the music placement, mastering, and mixing work that I do. Thanks again for listening to and supporting Lost Arts Radio. We love having you as part of our family to learn, experience, and grow with.
Oh, every time I see you, baby, you seem quiet as a mouse. You ain't talked to me nice since I lost my job, my car, and my house. Every week I see you, I'm wishing you would still be mine. And it doesn't help a bit, baby, that you're the clerk giving me my check in the welfare line. When I'm down and out, you see me, I look like a worthless bum. When I get it together, baby, you won't see me because I won't have to come. Oh, I pray for the day I won't need your check no more. But then I guess you won't be much impressed with me if I ain't even walking in the door. I'll try to borrow my buddy's car. Maybe he'll loan me his suit. I'll be able to take you out, baby, just as soon as you give me my loot. It's a shame, shame, shame I got to crawl for you this way. But damn, if I don't have to crawl, I guess that means you don't have to give me my pay. To tell me you love me, it's not like a major decision. Just look at it like a kickback, baby, a benefit of your position. I can't put you and two other guys on the moon. I ain't got no spaceship, baby, but on Friday I can get you a steak, a drink, and a room.